kind of nestled among the different stories in Parshas Ba'aloscha, we're also told about a conversation that Moshe has with his father-in-law, Yisro. So Yisro has joined the Jewish people, and he he's kind of, I was about to say when he came, but I guess that's a little bit of a discussion. When Parshas Yisro, when that part of the story actually happens, is it before Matan Torah, as it is written, or maybe it happens after Matan Torah? Okay, but either way, Yisro has joined the Jewish people in the Midbar, and Moshe now has a conversation with him about moving forward, about what's going to happen in the future with Yisro. So those are the sources at the top of page one. So we have... Vayomer Elav, so Yisro says back to him, Lo Eilech, no, I'm not going to go. I'm not going to go with you. Ki im el artziv el moladati Eilech. I'm going to go back to my homeland. Okay? So Moshe is trying to convince him, come along with us. Come with us. And Yisro says, no, I'm actually going to go back home, back to my native land, right? Moladati. Okay, Vayomer. Al na tazovo sanu. So Moshe says back to Yisro, don't abandon us, don't leave us. Ki alkein yadata chanosenu bamidbar. This ki alkein is like a little bit of a funny phrasing. Ki alkein yadata chanosenu bamidbar, for you have known our camping in the desert. So you've seen our camp, you've been here, you've been a part of it. V'hayisalanu le'inayim. V'hayisalanu le'inayim. And you will be, lanu, you'll be for us as eyes. Literally is what it means. V'hayisalanu le'inayim. You'll be eyes for us.
Is v'hayis a past or future?
So that's part of the question. That's one of the notes.
Already did with the judges.
Okay, great. Okay, so this phrase "V'ha'isa lanu le'inayim" also itself "V'ha'isa" is the word "and you were" "V'ha'isa" you were, or is it "V'ha'isa" like in Tanakh where it switches it to the future? So "V'ha'isa" right could be "and you will be." So that itself is a little bit unclear. "V'ha'isa lanu le'inayim" and you were eyes. "V'ha'ya kisei lechimanu." And if you go with us, v'hayaha tov hahu asher yitiv Hashem imanu v'hitavnu lach. So then the tov that Hashem is going to do with us, he will also do to you, right? So come with us. It'll be great. You'll go to the land. God's going to give us, what we need. You'll be included in that. You'll be a part of it. And that's Moshe's pitch. And then the pasuk says, the next pasuk, Vayisu mehar Hashem, and they travel from Har Hashem, Derech Shloshes Yamim, a three-day journey, Va'aron Bris Hashem Noseh Lifneim, and the Aron is traveling in front of them, Derech Shloshes Yamim, Lasur Lahem Menucha. Okay, so the Aron is traveling in front of them. So before we go back into the story, right, we should just point out that the resolution of this story is unclear. It's not so obvious what ends up happening, right? There are certain times we have... or you have certain stories in the Chumash that seem to end with like somebody's speech, and then it doesn't say like and then they did that or and then it happened or right. So you find this periodically that Moshe Yisro says, "I think I'm going to go home," and Moshe says, "No, stay with us." And then jump cut to the Jewish people traveling through the Midbar, and now. It's not so obvious whether Yisro was convinced by Moshe's argument, or he in fact went home, and you find slightly different opinions about that. So the Chumash doesn't, in this case, doesn't really seem to spell out what ended up actually happening with Yisro. Right, long term, right, we should realize that we also refer to him as Canaan, also in the context of the story, and right, you have other names of Yisro, and you do seem to find the Kaini that are living in Eretz Yisrael later on in Tanakh. So the Kaini are descendants of Yisro and his family. So you do find, right, so in some way, some part of the family seem to have ended up in Eretz Yisrael, right? That, right, when did the Kaini come up?
By Yael.
Right, exactly. So that's one time by Yael. Yael is married to Chever HaKaini, When the Jewish people are fighting Sisera and they're fighting a war, right, one of the families that's involved, right, or gets involved, really, is a family, Cainy. When Shaul is fighting Amalek, he warns the Cainy, you probably don't want to be involved in this. You probably want to, you know, leave. So he tells them to kind of make some space for the battle. So they seem to have ended up there in some way. As far as Yisro himself in this story, we should just recognize that, like, the transition between psukim is not so clear. On this phrase, v'hayisalanu le'inayim, v'hayisalanu le'inayim. So we can't give some explanation without starting with Rashi. Gotta start with Rashi. So v'hayisalanu le'inayim. So he says, what does this mean? V'hayisalanu le'inayim, lashon avar. So it could be that you have to read it in past tense, kitargumo, as Unkelus does. So the Targum, if you look in the Targum Unkelus, you'll see that the way he reads this sentence is describing things that Yisro saw in the past, right? He's saying that you did see these things. In the English that's on your page here, it happens to add the actual words of Unkelus, which Rashi doesn't do, but the translation here actually does. So it gives you a sense of what Unkelus actually says. So if you look here in the English translation, it says, right, so it's the past tense, just like the Targum renders it, right? And this is what the Targum says, is, and, sorry, you just in the, remember the sentence. So the sentence is, Kalkenia data chanoseinu b'midbar, you saw our camping in the midbar, and all the mighty deeds that have been wrought for us, you have seen with your own eyes, right? So you came to the desert. You've seen all these things. You've seen the miracles. So that's Vayisalanu Le'inayim. Yisro, you've seen everything that happened to us. V'hayaki seidechimanu, right? And therefore, right, you know that Hashem is leading us, and all the good that God is going to do for us, God will do for you. So it could be that it is actually past tense. Okay, Rashi says davar acher losho nasid, right? That it's actually future. It's actually referring to something that will happen. Kol davar v'davar sheyis alein me'einenu tia me'ir einenu. So what does it mean that Yisro, you will be eyes for us? It means anything that will be hidden from our eyes, okay, anything that will be yis alein me'einenu, hidden from our eyes, so you are going to enlighten our eyes to it. You're going to see it for us. So that would be the future. You will be eyes for us. Now, one of the questions, which is we're going to deal with, right? The main question we're really going to deal with is, I think, focusing on this answer. I'd like to discuss, like, some ideas of what are those things, right? That the Jewish people are in the midbar. They're traveling on their way to Eretz Yisrael. What could it be that the Jewish people don't know, and Yisro is going to be the one to tell them about, right? So, on one hand, it makes sense. Vayisa lanu le'inenu, you're going to be our eyes, right? That's what it would mean. You'll be our eyes. You'll see it for us. What do they need Yisro to see that they wouldn't have seen? So this phrase, Vaisalano Le'inenu, Le'inayim, sorry, Rashi gives an explanation, but I think there's a little bit more to elaborate on. And Rashi actually gives a third explanation, which we won't spend time on, but Davarachishte Chaviv Aleinu Kigal Galeinenu, that you will be beloved to us, Chaviv, like Gal Galeinenu, the orbs of our eyes, our eyeballs. Shenamar Vahavtem Esager, because we'll take as careful care of you as we would our own, you know, eyes that require care and love. So just you'll be like eyes in that sense, as we are commanded, v'aftam esager, that we have to take care of the stranger. So those are the three explanations of Rashi. That it's the past tense, maybe it's the future, and Yisro will reveal stuff to us, or perhaps maybe it is. It is just part of, right, the last explanation. Perhaps it kind of fits with the speech that Moshe is giving. He's trying to convince Yisro to stay, right? And so it kind of fits that it's not just like stay because we need you, but it's stay because right? We love you. We're going to take care of you. We want you to be a part of it. So the last explanation kind of has a little bit of that flavor, that it's a little bit more of trying to tell Yisro why he should stay, as opposed to just like convincing him that, you know, it's stay because we'll benefit. It's stay because you'll benefit. Stay, you'll be better off too.
But also could be that, you know, you're going to ask a lot of questions about what did the second one mean. So that Rashi might have said, okay, I really don't think it's past tense, but okay, Uncle said it's past tense. I think it's future. Okay, but there's going to be a lot of questions about what I'm going to say right now. About,
right.
You know. So here's another way to say it's still in the future.
Yeah. Yeah. So we're addressing this idea, even though this year is not exactly like the what's bothering Rashi kind of shir per se. We're getting into Rashi, right? If you look at the Mefarshei Rashi, the commentaries on Rashi are going to explain, especially when, right, not just what was bothering Rashi to begin with, but when Rashi gives more than one explanation, the commentaries on Rashi are going to explain, well, why was the first answer not sufficient? Why did you need to give a second answer, right? What might have been lacking in the first answer that the second answer accounts for? And then in this case, Rashi gives a third one. So apparently there's something in the second answer that wasn't good enough that Rashi has to give potentially a third answer. So to that end, right, it's kind of building, it sounds like, Rashi's two answers, right, his own answers, right? One was freely from the Targum. And Rashi apparently says, yeah, I don't really think it's the past tense. It's really the future tense. But this middle answer seems there might be something wrong with it, and that's why he gives the third answer. So I'd like to kind of maybe defend that second answer, explain it a little bit.
The first answer and the third answer, he tells you where it comes from. The second answer, it's his.
We'd have to look in the Sifri. We'd have to look in the Sifri to see. I don't remember. I didn't look up that source specifically to see what the original. If the Medrash includes this, it's called Avar Vidavar Sheyisali Me'inenu. It's a good question. So I have to do my homework better next time. Okay. So in this conversation, first I want to bring a comment of Haksav HaKabbalah. So Rav Yaakov Mecklenburg, we're going to see. His answer doesn't really fit the second answer of Rashi, but he kind of spells out the question. So in Haksav HaKabbalah, Rav Mecklenburg says, "Achar shelo hayinu nitzrachim b'midbar l'more derech." Okay, since in the midbar, we don't need a more derech. We don't need someone to tell us where to go, right? We don't need anyone to teach us how to get there. Why? Lehalichas amud ha'ish v'ha'anan lifnei ha'machane. Right? Because who's leading the camp? They don't need Yisro to come in. Oh, you know the area. Why don't you show us? You'll be the tour guide to show us how to get there, because they're following the pillar of fire and the cloud, right? So Hashem is literally walking them through. Hashem is leading them. Lifnei hamachne. Okay. Im kein in makom lafarish lashon v'ha'is alanu le'inayim lahoros hadarech v'chadome. So he actually thinks that there's. We don't want to say Vayisalanu Le'inayim that you're going to be eyes for us is to show us what to do because in fact they don't need him. They don't need him to show them because Hashem is leading them through the camp.
Yeah, so you will enlighten our eyes about it. What could there possibly be, just based on what you just said, what could there possibly be in the desert that Yitro would know or could have seen?
Yeah.
His time in the desert would not be any great exploration of desert life.
Yeah, exactly. Right? So based on this question...
And what significance would it have for them anyway?
Exactly. So we see...
Is going so we see
from...
The whole time.
Exactly. So we see from Aksav HaKabbalah, he's spelling out this question that I think right is really getting at this middle answer of Rashi, right? This middle answer of Rashi that that he's going to reveal something to them, right? What is it that Yisro could possibly reveal to them that that they wouldn't already know, and that it doesn't seem like it's literally how to get there. It doesn't seem like it's you know, directing where to go, because they already know how to go. They already have a way to get there. They already have the GPS, right, that's telling them where to go. So what else is Yisro going to be adding? So,
you know, sometimes when a person, you want to see something through somebody else's eyes because they have a different view of what it is.
Okay.
Here's a person who lived in the desert his whole life. When he sees a nes min shamayim, he knows it's a nes min shamayim.
Okay.
As opposed to people who lived in slavery in Egypt and
not okay, so the perspective here that he may be adding is something about the miraculous nature of the Jewish people's time in the Midbar, which is I don't know that I don't see that as much in this middle answer of Rashi. Right? Rashi says something that's Yisalei Meinin, something that we're missing. Right? He's going to enlighten us. You're saying that they don't necessarily realize the extent to which something's happening, and he can reveal that to them. But the direction that you're going is actually similar to Haksav HaKabbalah. What he says is, based on this question, he says, "V'nira li b'kavanas hamikra ki achareish yadata ofen chana yaseinu bamidbar." So look back at the pasuk that it's ki alkein yadata chanoseinu bamidbar, right? For you have known our camping in the desert, right? So because Yisro knows the camping in the desert, shahaisa malaya nisim ugvuros, right? Yisro witnesses that the camping in the desert is full of miracles. He sees the moon falling. You didn't look ahead. Okay, but that's why, right? This question, right, leads us may you know nicely lead us into this idea that it's not about showing them the way. It's about the fact that he witnessed the miracles, right? His perspective on the miracles, and why is that important? Bazet yalanu leinaim. So now he says it a little bit different than we might have said before, right? It's not just you've seen the miracles, but then what's this phrase, v'ha'isa lanu le'inayim? How are you going to be our eyes? What it means is, le'edus bifnei ha'umos. Right, that now Yisro is a worthwhile, right, if we need a testimonial to everybody else, to any other nation, to convince anybody else, so then Yisro is the guy. Yisro is the person who, because you, Yisro, you with your own eyes have seen the miracles that we've experienced. They're going to listen to your words, and they'll take it to heart. And they're going to find it more convincing. They're going to find it more convincing to get on board with the mission of the Jewish people if Yisro tells them why, as he says in the next line, ki li yoscha tak kohen midyan. Right, Yisro, you're not part of the Jewish people. You weren't part of our family. You were you're a priest of Midian. You're somebody who's a man of the world. You were out there. You were worshiping Avodah Zarah. You were exploring. You were looking at things. Right, you're somebody who's already accepted by the world at large. And if you now come with this message, I've seen it all, and I know that this is the real thing. So then, people are going to find that much more convincing. So vahisa lanu le'inayim, you're going to be the eyes, means that your vision, your testimony, your seeing this experience in the Midbar is going to serve as a testimony to the world, to the rest of the nations, and it will be much more convincing to everybody else.
Wouldn't that be a reason why he would go home and talk to them and not stay with them?
So it is interesting. Why, if this is the case, the question is, so then wouldn't it make more sense to let Yisro go home, right? Send Yisro home and let him spread the message in Midian. I don't remember him clarifying this in the comment. Maybe it is towards the end. But it could be that the people they're most interested in convincing at this time are the people in the direction that they're going, right? They don't necessarily need people in, like, at this point, right, in the corners of the land. They don't necessarily need people.
You will help us, you know, the seven nations.
Right, exactly. So maybe maybe the seven nations that are already there, right? So there is a conversation that started in theory, right? They would have the opportunity to get on board with it. So maybe with him as part of the crew, the conversations can go differently, right? We do know that there is a if we can just speculate, right? This is obviously just speculation, but like in the sense that when they do enter the land, right? They are aware of the Jewish people coming, right? Rachav, who is one of the first people that they meet, right, in Yericho. So she does say, everybody's afraid. People know that you're coming. To some extent, there were many who may have been ready for a little bit of an extra, who may have just needed an extra little push to go along with it. The leadership of the land, doubled down and was like, no, but we're going to fight it. And so, maybe if there was some more, maybe Yisrael could have made a little bit of a change, right? Rachav herself does end up siding with the Jewish people, but maybe there were others. Maybe it could have gone differently for people.
Also making Yisrael feel good. I mean, that might have been
right. There's also kind of like building up Yisrael. You're saying to keep him in place. But even though that may be the path that Moshe is choosing to like talk to Yisrael, but it does right. It's not just for the sake of. It doesn't seem like it's just for the sake of making Yisrael feel that, but it is. It also does have a. There is a reason, right? Moshe is not making up a reason. It would actually, it would actually be worthwhile. So that's the approach of Haksava Kabbalah, and again, what seems to be what's kind of pushing him towards this explanation, which sounds a little bit more like the Unkelus, right? That you've seen the miracles. So he goes another step. It's not just you've seen the miracles, but the phrase "Veisalanu Leinayim" means, right? You, as the person who saw it, you actually can tell people about it. So he goes another step on top of Unkelus. But what seems to be driving that is why would they need Yisro as eyes, right? That seems to be the issue. So. Okay, so I want to present two explanations for why we might need Yisro. What would Yisro be adding to this to our knowledge that we would not have known otherwise? So the first one we're going to look at is from the Hamik Davar. So the Hamik Davar is the commentary of the Nitziv. Okay, he's known as the Nitziv, Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin. So he is writing. He's actually writing around the same time. He's living around the same time as Haksava Kabbalah. I don't know if he's writing it maybe a little bit later. I'm not sure exactly, but they're both around the same the same area in the 19th century. So the Nitziv says the following in his commentary. So he says, "Ubiyosenu b'midbar." Okay, since we're in the midbar. And we need to understand the people in the nations that we are approaching and that we are close to. We don't know anybody in the midbar. We don't know anything that's going on in the desert. And you know it well. This is El Nachon is also Al Kenya Data. It was also like a little bit of a grammatical point about the phrase Ki Al Kenya Data. So we're not going to get into that, but that's like his phrasing that he's alluding to. But he says we need to understand the umos that are around us in the midbar, and we don't know anything. We don't know any of them, right? We've been slaves in Mitzrayim this whole time. You are going to be our eyes. Lamora derech kan samuch zo ha'ir v'zo ha'uma. You're going to help us navigate, the different cities and nations that we are going to be approaching and near. You're going to help us figure out all that social information that we need to understand the people that we're going to be next to, or that we're going to be passing by. You're going to help us understand what the situation is on the ground, so that we can properly get through the Midbar.
He's going to be the chief spy.
Okay, so perhaps you're phrasing it as a spy. So perhaps it's a question of a spy. So it's funny that again, I don't know if either of them are responding to each other. I don't know, historically about these two commentaries, or if they're really borrowing a phrase that was used earlier, or it's just the obvious phrase. But they both use the phrase l'morei derech. So Haksav HaKabbalah says you don't need him to be a morei derech, right? You don't need him l'morei derech. And then the Netziv says, and he's going to be the morei derech. He's going to teach them. So apparently the Netziv thinks there is something about the actual trip that they're going on that Yisro will be able to shed light on. So when Haksav HaKabbalah, right, where Rav Mecklenburg said, they're just following the cloud. What's the difference? They're following the cloud. So the Amik Davar says, no, but you still need somebody to tell you what to do. You still need somebody to give you information about this, the lands you're passing through, and the countries you're going to be camping next to, and the cities you're going to be near, and the people you're going to be dealing with. So even so, right, the Hamik Davar seems to say, even so, you still need Yisro to actually do that. And you're phrasing it as a spy, and again, we might say
it was tongue in cheek.
No, I know, but I mean, there is something to it, right? Like, which is like, how do they get the information? But it's like, in this case, it's like literally
he's giving him cultural back.
Right. Exactly. So that's just to elaborate on that.
I forgot those guys who went to the Louisiana Purchase. They had an Indian scout.
Well, right. Lewis and Clark. There's you bring around some. A local to make those connections and to explain and to make sure that you're not committing any huge faux pas that like is gonna break things down, right? So Yisro,
Parsha Shlach, Moshe telling the spies, if you want to call them that, what to do, he tell you, wants to know what the people are like and.
Okay, so that's also why I wanted to like get on that word spy, because next week they actually are going to send spies specifically. Perhaps again, I don't know that this is what the Netziv is going to say, but like it could be. Well, maybe they lose Yisro now, and they need to go get their own information, right? Maybe they do, right? They do actually need to understand the people in a different way. So maybe that is one of the reasons they need to send people, right? Maybe they do actually. Need to gather the information on their own because they don't have somebody who can say, watch out with these people, this is what they care about, make sure you don't get too close to them. So all of these different things that Yisro can elaborate on. And
excuse me.
Sorry, a question before I say the next thing. You have a question? Red?
Yisro was Moshe's father-in-law, right?
Yes.
Okay, so maybe there was a little bit of a personal thing here. It would make his wife happy to have her father.
Yeah, there. Yeah.
That's a number one. Number two, he could maybe keep an eye on him he was a priest of Midian.
Right.
And I'm assuming now he's accepted the being Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
Well, keep an eye on him.
Right. So again, there may be other reasons that it's better to keep Yisro in the camp. That may be kind of on the outside. In this case, Moshe. So Moshe's giving his reason. Moshe's giving his reason. I guess part of the question you're asking, which is a little bit deeper, but the question is like, is this reason that he says the only reason that he would want him to stay? Right? Do we have reason to think that there might be additional reasons to keep Yisro around? Which is an interesting question. So it could be that there are other details going on. But as far as what Moshe is saying, as far as Moshe's telling him, there actually is a purpose, there actually is a benefit to the Jewish people to have Yisro around, and that would be, the social context and the political environment that they're entering that they really don't know anything about. And I think this answer also just speaks to another, I don't know about a shift, I guess it kind of just depends on how we picture the time of Bnei Israel in the Midbar, right? We think of the Jews traveling through the Midbar as, they're this huge camp and they're just in this vast wasteland. And they spend 38 years, we say 40 years, but they're already, they're starting in the second year at this point. So, right, that they're about to spend 38 years, right, in nothingness and emptiness and just, you know, sand dunes. And that's kind of what we picture as Bnei Israel traveling through the Midbar. But we see other indications that that's not really the case, right? That's partially true, and maybe there are years that they spend like that, but they do also, in different ways, interact with or come in contact with other people who are in the Midbar. There are other times that they're meeting with people. I was looking up again. There's a Targum in Shir Shirim that spells out right that there's one of the questions about different supplies that they have in the Midbar. So in the Midbar, they also get the command to give what are called nesachim in the Mishkan, right? So along with the korban, you also have some sort of wine that goes with it. You also have like a korban mincha, which is from grain. Like, where do they get these things? Where do they get these things in the Midbar? How do you have wine and grain? Like, are they growing them in the desert? So how are they doing it? So the Targum explains in Shir Shirim that they would actually send people. They actually would send a crew to Ein Gedi, right? They would send people into the land, and they would gather up the stuff that they need. So, and you have other sources which elaborate that, like, they would buy, like, they could buy it from people. Like, they would interact with other people. There are merchants around, right? Just like, right, the merchants who take Yosef, and you have a caravan that's traveling through, and you also have communities that are living in the Midbar. So they also could buy things, and they're also interacting with people. So this nation of people who've just, you know, they've been slaves for hundreds of years, and then they walk out, and now they're going to walk into a store, right, and start trying to buy things and trying to haggle for figuring out prices. So what do they know? They don't know who to buy from. They don't know, you know, who's going to take advantage of them. They don't know they're going to walk in and start a war by accident because they've walked into the wrong city. So these people, they could use a little help. So it's true that Hashem is literally walking them down the path, but there's still this leeway. There's still this other step of the Jewish people's interactions in the Midbar that Yisro actually could shed light on. That the people would benefit from having Yisro around for this general context and this way of interacting with the world that they actually may not be privy to themselves. So that's one thought.
Whatever answer you're going to come up with for number two, don't you then sort of open up the whole discussion of Ishtadlus, Somkin al Hashem, Ein Somkin al Nes. I mean, whatever answer it is, it's either too good, and therefore, why aren't you relying on Hashem? Or, you know,
So this is also, I'm saying this without having gone through the whole Hamik Davar on Bamidbar, but as a general approach to Sefer Bamidbar, so the Netziv points out in his introduction. So he has an introduction, just to clarify, he has an introduction to each Sefer of the Chumash. And in it, he explains, based on the name that Chazal give to the Sefer, he explains, you know, what is the theme? What is the overall idea of the Sefer? So we had kind of mentioned this, that Sefer HaMidbar is called Sefer HaPekudim, the counting. So in that context, in explaining that name, so the Netziv kind of lays down his major theme of Sefer Bamidbar is that Bamidbar is the transition of the Jewish people starting as a miraculously sustained people to a people who will function in the world, in the land that they will be living in. And that Bamidbar is this switch. So they've left in Mitzrayim, you know, with all these very clear miracles, very open miracles. You know, they've built the Mishkan and they've been relying on that. But Bamidbar is like almost weaning them off of the miracles and the man and the right. They're going to have to make their own food. They're going to not have a miracle worker to solve their problems whenever there's a national crisis, right? They're not going to have Moshe to just do things for them. And they're going to have to learn how to do things on their own. So the idea that once they start leaving Har Sinai, right, once they start leaving Midbar Sinai and they start traveling what they assume is basically into Eretz Yisrael, they are now trying to switch over to a more natural type of living, which requires Hishtadlus and them actually taking part in it, and them perhaps, you know, forming, you know, their own, I don't want to say army, right? In this case, right, they're building the army, and they're working towards that, and that requires intelligence, and that requires understanding, and like those pieces actually are part of the process right now. Now, again, that kind of gets almost like stunted in that, well, now they actually have to spend 38 more years in the Midbar, and the process actually takes a little bit longer. But this the Nitziv says, actually gets to Moshe's sin, that when Moshe eventually, right, we're going to see at the end of their time in the Midbar, Moshe actually, the sin of Moshe when he hits the rock. So the Nitziv says, the problem is that they're supposed to be learning how to deal with this issue as a nation, and Moshe is doing the same miracles that he's been doing all along and not teaching them how to do it. So that he sees this as like a theme that continues throughout. So with that kind of lens, then it kind of fits also that this is part of that process. So I don't know that I can point to like this is the time that they were supposed to switch, but the idea that they're supposed to be transitioning into this type of life, I think is an overall idea that the Nesiv wants us to see in Sefer Bamidbar.
It's time to grow up. Some people take some longer than others.
So it takes a little longer. And then that's part of Moshe's job also in the Midbar. So to that end, I think this second answer, right? I'm going to say second answer, and it's going to be confusing which one we're talking about, two or three, right? The Haksava Kabbalah, he kind of gave an explanation also, so I don't want to get confused with him, right? And then we just looked at the Hamek Davar. So the Hamek Davar, and we're going to see Rav Sternbach. So the two of them are really elaborating on this idea that there actually is something that Yisro, as someone who is not part of Bnei Yisrael, somebody who's specifically not part of the Jewish people, there's something that he can add that Bnei Yisrael themselves would not have been able to see, right? So that's kind of what they have in common, that they're trying to figure out what is it that Bnei Yisrael as a people are missing that Yisro is actually going to be bringing into the picture that they wouldn't have had otherwise. And that's kind of the direction that they go. So that's why what I want to add from a couple of weeks ago we had a little conversation about superordinate team identity, superordinate identity, which was this idea that when the Jewish people are counted, it's not just the individuals, but it's also this overarching identity as a people. So that's a superordinate, means kind of zooming out and looking at this bigger picture. It's not just the individuals, but it's also everybody as a whole. And that was kind of the main idea of in Parshas Bamidbar. We're talking about this superordinate identity, this idea that everybody. And then when we talked about the camping, right, from the Emes Yaakov, that everybody, each tribe might be set aside in the camp, right? But you can't really set everybody else aside until you first make sure that there is an overarching team that everybody's a part of, right? An overarching identity of a nation, to make sure that when we have the Mishkan in the center, that brings everyone together, everyone's pointing towards the same point, so then we can start to pull people apart. So that was kind of the focus on the superordinate, the bigger idea. And I want to drive down a little bit more into this idea of the individual, and recognizing that not only one, we talked about diversity a little bit, that people are different, but another aspect to diversity, okay, another aspect of what makes people different is our networks. Okay, that our network is different. So you could have people that are sitting around the table, and what makes us unique is our personality. Some people are a little bit more creative. Some people are a little bit more open to new things. Some people are a little bit more conscientious. Right, those are aspects of personality that make us unique, that make us different. Another source of uniqueness is the network that each person has. So if we are all sitting around the table, one of the things that I bring to the table that's different than other people are the connections that I have outside of this group. There are other places, there are other connections that I have which are different than what other people have. So if we take one friend group and we just pull two people out of that friend group, so then a lot of them, those two people, they're coming from the same circle. They generally have the same view, the same perspective. They're basically going to have the same information because they're coming from the same friend group. And when you share information, when you share ideas, you often share it with the people you have the strongest connections to. So if you find people who have a strong connection to each other and you just pull out a couple of those people, yeah, each person is a little bit different. Each person is unique, but a lot of their network, the context, where they get information from is largely the same. So the question of the study that's in front of you was, is there a benefit to bringing in people who actually have different networks from each other? So if you have a group of people together, but those individuals are actually connected to different people, right? So is there a benefit to that? So in this study, they were talking about there are kind of two sides, because on one hand, if I take two people, right, let's imagine, again, I have a friend group and I'm pulling two people to do a task. I want them to do a job. So on one hand, they might share, they basically have the same information, but on the other hand, they're friends. So they're probably going to get along well. They're probably going to be able to communicate well because they've done it before. So the question is, if I pull two people who are actually very different from each other, the fact that they have different information makes it harder to communicate. The fact that they're not used to communicating with each other makes it harder to have those conversations, right? So which one is it? Are they going to benefit because they're diverse, because their information is different? Are they going to benefit from that? Or are they actually going to – it's actually going to make things worse because you're taking such different people and you're putting them in the same on the same job that you're actually going to lose all the benefits. So there's like they present an optimistic view. The optimistic view is that if you pull in members from different cohorts, they're going to do better because members who have entered the organization at different times know a different set of people and often have different technical skills and different perspectives on the organization's history. So if you pull in people who have different networks from each other, so you're actually going to bring in different perspectives and more information. And in general, bringing in more information is going to be helpful, right? So homogeneous groups may in fact be more harmonious. The performance of the teams actually might be limited because the information is redundant, because they know the same thing. Okay, so those are the two basic perspectives.
That's only if they're willing to
sit down together.
Oh, okay, great. So, okay, fine. So
if you take the Democrats,
oh, all right. Now we're gonna right. Okay, fine.
And so willing to
fine. So this that's why I see this as kind of like the flip side, right? This is drilling down on a point that we made a couple of weeks ago, which is about last time we pointed out there's a superordinate identity. There's some bigger picture, right, that we can recognize we're part of a team, right? If you can't get people to say we're part of the same team, so then the conversation is not going anywhere, right? We're not even going to be able to start it. But now that I said, okay, you're all part of a team, we're willing to work on it. The question is, what types of diversity actually benefit, end up actually benefiting? Is it just the fact that we have different perspectives? Is it just that our personalities are a little bit different? And this is adding something unique. This is adding something different. If we say we're part of a team, we're part of a group, and not only that, but the assumption is I'm putting people in who have very different networks. I thought about putting in one of these. They have like little maps of networks. So this is a kind of like a newer area of study, which is studying, again, like social networks. And they do it in the world at large. They've done it in some schools and organizations, right? You may come across in like businesses where they'll be like, who are like the main connecting points to everybody else, right? Like you need to make certain changes of the people who have the most connections to others, not the person who has the most like formal power. So that's like an area that I've kind of been elaborating on, that it may not just be, don't just start with the boss, start with the boss and also the person who communicates the most to everybody else, because they're going to have the biggest influence. So that's why there's like been kind of a little bit of a newer area in the past, again, this is 2001, but again, like kind of the past couple decades, right? Organizational, right? These studies, even social science has been going on for, you know, hundreds, right? But now the past couple decades, though, they've been elaborating on this network idea. Okay. So when it comes to networks, what do we see? So what they found was that this idea of a network actually added beyond just the differences in people. Okay, a direct examination of the frequency of interaction. Okay, so that's what they were looking at. It's even like a very simplified form, but they measured connections based on like how frequently you interacted with other people or how frequently you emailed other people. So when they looked at scientific teams, and they wanted to look at R&D teams, and they wanted to look at, right, and they looked at productivity and patents that were made and products that were put out to market. And they measured teams that were actually producing things. So what they found was interaction across the organization on a team sheds light on the relationship in a way that was unattainable if you only focused on demographic composition, right? So it's a complicated sentence, but the point is what we just said, that what they found is if you just look at, you know, this person's personality or this person, how many years were they in the organization? Or you looked at just basic demographic differences, that didn't account for everything. There is an additional layer, which is that my network is different than your network. The information that I have is different. Okay, so network heterogeneity, the differences in the networks, actually adds positive and significant findings to how productive these teams actually were. Okay, the estimate indicates that communication ties enriches the research process and promotes greater productivity, so it actually grows beyond that. The extent that diversity increases network heterogeneity, okay, so provide support for the position of the optimists, right? So if we want to know, in general, where you said there are two positions, do we say, I'm optimistic because you're very different from each other? Or I should be pessimistic because you're so different from each other, maybe you can't even have a conversation. So in this study, they found reason to be optimistic and to say, people who are different, that adds a layer. But not only that, but if you actually have a different network than each other, you actually have connections to other people. So then that adds even more to this, to our productivity. Okay. So again, this is going beyond just saying, my perspective is different. My life experience is different. I have a different view. I have a different personality. It's actually the fact that I'm connected to different people brings in even more. Okay. So it's this idea that we were talking about a couple of weeks ago. We're talking about this bigger team idea versus diversity. And the bigger team idea is very important. That's what they were building in Parshas Bamidbar. But now driving into the diversity part, it's not just about the fact that we are different, but the fact that we are different, we are connected to different groups. Okay? And that to some extent is the idea that we're talking about when we talk about Yisro as an outsider, is not just that he has a different perspective, but it's, as the Nitziv is saying, it's the fact that he is connected to a whole different set of things than us. It's not just that Yisro, as somebody from the outside, he's going to think a little differently than us, but it's the fact that he has information, he has friendships out there, he has connections out there, he has information that's coming from a different place than us, and that role of the outsider is different than we've said before. So that's really what we're bringing in from Yisro, is it's not just that he's an outsider in the sense that he thinks differently, it's the fact that he actually is connected to different things than us, and that is something we recognize. We actually want that around. We need to have those connections to something else, because you're bringing something different to the table that we don't have. So what are these things that Yis'ale me'ininu, it might be hidden from our eyes, but Yisro actually literally can bring in information from other places that we wouldn't have because he has those other connections. The Tam Vidas, there's a Sefer Tam Vidas from Rav Sternbach. He takes, again, a little bit of a different perspective. It's a little bit more of the classic perspective that we've been saying in other situations, which is, he says, we'll just say quickly, that that as a, in his terminology, as a Baal Tshuva, right, as somebody who didn't start as part of the Jewish people, but is coming in, there are certain assumptions, right, that the Jewish, that somebody who's raised in this life, somebody who comes in from the beginning, makes certain assumptions or has a certain understanding that is going to be different than somebody who's come to it through delving into it and philosophy and thinking about it and looking at it deeper. So this idea that he says, but there, those who are raised in it, they're going to go as a, you know, it's normal, it's natural, this is just my habit, this is the way that I do it. But he's going to come not just as a habit, but as understanding. So the fact that we want Yisro around, there are going to be certain things that we're not going to question, we're not going to take into account, we're not really going to think about, but Yisro is actually going to bring a perspective to it that's going to be an understanding of it that's different than we have. So these two ideas, again, I think the Talmud Vidas is a little bit more of the classic perspective of diversity. We talk about, like, he's going to have a different view of it. He's going to question assumptions. And I think the Nativ gives us a new layer to that, which is, it's not just about bringing in somebody from the outside because they think a little differently, but because they actually are bringing in information from other places, they have connections that we don't have. And the important role of the outsider in making those connections, in bridging those gaps between different groups. So I think that we see, right, so we saw Yisro was, Moshe was trying to convince Yisro, Vayisa lanu le'inayim, you should be our eyes, you should be our eyes. How, in what sense is Yisro going to be the eyes of the Jewish people? So we had a few explanations in Rashi, but I think they were elaborated upon. So if we just focus on the Haksav HaKabbalah and the other explanations, right, that Haksav HaKabbalah was saying, no, you see the miracles and you can then tell everybody about it. You have a role to play because you saw everything, you can testify to it. And then that's one approach, kind of like the things you saw in the past and you can testify to it. And the Hamik Davar and Rav Sternbach, so they're pointing to there are certain things that we may take for granted, we may not see as the Jewish people, but you actually can bring in something. You, Yisro, are actually bringing in something from the outside that we would not have had. And it's important to think about this again: the role of the outsider, the important role that connecting to somebody outside of our immediate and strongest circles can actually benefit, can benefit us. And can in some ways make us more productive, and also can make us more understanding of the world when we're not only bouncing the same information off of each other, but we're actually able to connect to people who are outside of that circle, who are going to be bringing us different perspectives.